Okay, so the truth of the matter is the Torah should have ended, I think, or it could have ended at the end of Bechukotai. And if you look at the last parsha, the last pasuk of the parsha, I can share my screen for a second just to show you. It's actually ending. And the ending is the last pasuk in Sefer Vayikra says like this: Ela mitzvot asher tzivah Adonai et Moshe b'nei Yisrael b'har Sinai. That's not how Shmot ends, right? These are the mitzvot that God commanded, Hashem commanded Moshe at Har Sinai. In other words, it seems like everything from Vayikra on, or some from Parshat Yitro through the end of the Parsha is all connected to Har Sinai. Rashi last week at the beginning of Shemitah, Bahar Sinai said, Ma'inyan Shemitah Leitzel Har Sinai. There's some connection, linking up back to Har Sinai. And this would just be a very nice ending point of the Torah. Because there really is no need, there should have been no need for most of Bamidbar. No Meraglim, at least according to Rashi, it was a bad idea to send the Meraglim. And if there's no Meraglim, there's no Korach, there's no rebellion against Moshe. And then there's no 40 years in the desert. And then there's no Bilam and Balak. And there's no Miriam and Aaron dying. And there's no nothing. The rest of Bamidbar doesn't really happen. And of course, Sefer Dvarim doesn't happen because the book of Sefer Dvarim is Moshe Rabbeinu preparing the Jewish people to enter the land of Israel. So had they, he's trying to tell the children not to make the same mistakes as their parents, which is why Sefer Dvarim opens up with the sin of the spies. And it doesn't open up with the sin of the golden calf because sin of the golden calf may be being worse, whatever, earlier. But the reason they didn't go to Israel is because of the Chein HaMeraglim. And therefore, that's what Moshe begins the book with. And of course, that's the whole book, is preparing the Jewish people. You're going there. Don't follow the Avodah Zarah of the people, et cetera, et cetera. And so we wouldn't have needed that. And the Torah could have ended. Of course, the question would have been, so maybe you would have had a short book. You would have had three and a third books, maybe the beginning of Bamidbar. Till really Vayihi bin Soa. Vayihi bin Soa is really the transition point. Rav Soloveitchik, if it's one of the shiurim, I heard him, on tape, a beautiful shiur in Valotcha, where you have Vayihi bin Soa, the backwards nun. The nun represents nefilah, falling, and that was basically the point after the complaining of the meat and the running away from Har Sinai and the Jewish people. Vayihi bin Soa sort of, is cordoned off. And from the beginning to the end, Rashi says, because you don't want to have too many bad things next to each other. So you complain, complain, complain. So we want to break up the complaint with Vayihi bin Soa, but that really marked the beginning of the end of the Jewish people. It's soon after they sent the spies. So Bechukotai should have been the end. And then so you'd have a little bit of Bamidbar. You could have thrown it into Vayikra at its own book. What is also interesting is then what would you have done with Sefer Dvarim? Anybody want to guess? Right, we all know that Sefer Dvarim is Mishneh Torah, which means what? What does Mishneh Torah mean?
A review.
A review, except if you were to tell somebody who never read the Chumash that Sefer Dvarim is a review, I want you to grade the book as a review of the first four books. So you'd get between, let's say, on a scale of 0 to 10, you'd get a 0. On a scale of 0 to 100, maybe you get 5. I don't know. And half of the Torah is not mentioned Dvarim. There's nothing about the Beit HaMikdash, nothing in Bereishit. So lots of stuff isn't there. It's not repetition. And then how many mitzvot? How many new mitzvot? Right? We assume there's 613 mitzvot in the Torah. So how many of those mitzvot appear in Sefer Dvarim? Anybody want to take a guess? 10, 5. I don't know. What mitzvah do you know that appears in Sefer Dvarim? Anybody? Hello?
Eglah Rufa.
Eglah Rufa. Whoa. Of all the mitzvot in Sefer Dvarim, pick on Eglah Rufa. That's great. That's great.
I took a swing at it.
I'm sorry. Eglah Rufa ties into Bereishit also. So you get two birds with one stone because that's the Parsha Yosef was learning with Yaakov. You know that weird, strange Rashi, right? When he left Bayarat HaAgalot, when Yosef sent back the wagon. So of course, what are the rabbis, driving at? What kind of ridiculous thing? He saw the wagons. He's learning Eglah Rufa. The whole thing makes absolutely no sense. Because, only people who are fools, according to the Rambam, take midrashim literally. But what it means is, what's Eglah Arufa? Is to leave somebody to go alone. The rabbis have to bring this, atonement because they let this person come and they didn't escort him home. And because of that, they're considered responsible. We didn't spill this blood. Who would have thought the rabbis, you know, they don't spill the blood. Of course not. But they didn't escort him. So that's exactly Yaakov and Yosef, that Yaakov sent Yosef to Shechem without escorting him. So that's why they were learning. They weren't learning Egla Rufa. The idea of Egla Rufa by Yartekalot, that's what the Midrash is driving at. But that's very nice. Nothing to do with what we're talking about, but that's one of the mitzvot in Sefer Dvarim. Shema's in Sefer Dvarim. The mitzvah of Tzedakah's in Sefer Dvarim. Getting married is in Sefer Dvarim. Lots of really, really important mitzvot that we don't hear anywhere else in the Torah are found in Sefer Dvarim, 199 of them. According to the Sefer HaChinuch, actually 200. Sefer Dvarim, I just looked it up before, in Sefer HaChinuch, Sefer Dvarim opens up at Mitzvah 414. So that means they're 200, right? 414 to 613. 200 of the 613 Mitzvot were at Sefer Dvarim. So it's a little bit strange for me to say, well, you wouldn't need Sefer Dvarim. But what it means is the theme of Sefer Dvarim wouldn't be needed. Those Mitzvot could have been recorded elsewhere. I mean, I don't know. I'm just, where they would have been recorded is interesting. When were those Mitzvot actually given? It's also a fascinating question. It's a question really that Rashi raised last week when Rashi says, Ma'inyan Shemitah Eitzel Har Sinai. What is the mitzvah Shemitah doing at Har Sinai? So Rashi answers all the mitzvot were given at Har Sinai, right? Every mitzvah was given. So how do we know that that's not literally true? I mean, the mitzvah to give the daughter's inheritance was given then at Mount Sinai? So how come Moshe didn't know about it when they came? If 414 is included, it's 201. No, it's 200. Because if 413 is included, it's 201, I think. 414 to 613 is exactly 200, I think. If I know how to do great two math. Anyway, there's so many things in the Torah. Obviously, Korach, so many mitzvot were said. And as a result of events that happened in Sefer Bamidbar. So it's really, it is not clear at all exactly what mitzvot were coming up to Shavuot. So what mitzvot were given at Har Sinai and what weren't. But the authority for all the mitzvot were given, but it's clear parts of the Torah were not given at Mount Sinai. Some were given in Arvad Moab, they're given later. There is a debate in the Gemara. How was the Torah itself given? Was the Torah given Megillah, Megillah, Niknait? Was the Torah given piecemeal? Like as it happened, you know? Parsha Korach happened, so they got Korach. Oh, they wrote Korach in the Torah. And Chukat happened, so they wrote Chukat. Or no, or Megillah that was given at the end. At the end, they give a one whole big Torah, and the Torah describes in the last day of Moshe's life, he's giving the Torah to the other tribes. But anyway, by being is thematically, in many ways, the Torah ends at Parshat Bichukotai. It also makes then for a lot of sense thematically why the Torah would end with blessings and curses. In other words, we get the Torah at Mount Sinai, and then we have all the mitzvot. So, by the way, I forgot to check. There are 200 mitzvot or 201. They're arguing whatever in Sefer Dvarim. I mean, we don't have an exact agreed upon list anyway. There are three in Bereishit, not so many in Bereishit. That gets us to 203. So we still have 410 left. So between Shmot, Bamidbar, and Vayikra, we got 410 left. So I forgot to look it up, but I know the most are in Vayikra. Vayikra is over 200. Shmot is a bunch, but not so many. You know, you guys got a lot in Mishpatim, but it's probably under 100. No, exactly. But Vayikra is the most mitzvot, followed by Dvarim, and then Shmot, Bamidbar, and Bereshit. But anyway, so they get the Torah at Mount Sinai, and the rest of the Torah from Yitro on till Bechukotai is mitzvah after mitzvah. There are no stories. That's it. Once we get to Parsh Yitro, the boring part of the Torah starts, right? The Mishkan, everybody falls asleep for 5 weeks. Thank God, Kitisa in the middle, so you can talk about the Cheda Egel. And then we get to the Korbanos, oh my God. And then you get Tazria Mitzorim, we're upset when it's not a leap year, because then when it is a leap year, because then we have to read Tazria Mitzorah in 2 weeks. When it's not a leap year, we can combine them, right? By the way, that's one of the reasons they give when Israel, I forget that. I have to think about that for a second. But Tazria Mitzorah, really, it's very technical. It's not applicable to today, but it's all mitzvot. It's all mitzvot. And the two stories, the story of Nadav and Abihu is a reaction to what happened in the Mishkan. And then the story of last week on the blasphemer. That's it. It's all lost. And then and therefore the Torah ends, quote unquote, the original Torah ends. God warns us, okay, now you better keep imbechukotai teilechu. If you follow the mitzvot, great. And if not, it's going to be very bad. And of course, when we have to restart the Torah again, so to speak, and we have Bamidbar and Dvarim, so guess what? At the end of Dvarim, we have again brachot and klalot. It's not right at the end. The Torah ends v'zot ha-bracha. It ends with Moshe's, you know, blessing, but we have the klalot again in Kitava, really towards the end of the Torah. Moshe gives his big long speech for the last few weeks of his life, and then he basically concludes that speech with the Tochacha. And if you look through Nitzavim Hanazinu, truth of the matter, they also are really part of the, almost part of the Tochacha too, in a certain sense, right? What's Nitzavim? Atem Nitzavim Ayom Kochem, Labrcha B'Brit, you better follow the covenant. Hazinu Hashemayim Baretz, listen to scribes, and if not, it's going to be bad news. So the Shema, the ending part of the Torah, like the end of Vayikra, the end of the Dvarim, are very similar in the idea of the Brachon and Klalot that Moshe Rabbeinu or HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving to the Jewish people. I'm afraid to share my screen. I'll try one more time because the last time I did my video went away. So, but maybe I'll do it in a moment. Okay. All right. So now we read B'chukotai. Why are we reading B'chukotai now? That's a silly question. Why read it like between Pesach and Shavuos? Why Bichukah? So because last week we read Bahar, and the week before we read Emor. So like that's what we're up to, you know. We started in Simchas Torah, we go week by week. So it turns out, you know, that we're here at Bichukotai before Shavuos time. We always read because everybody knows what you have to read before Shavuot. Hello, anybody? Right?
Read the Klalot.
Bamidbar, no? Okay. So see, there you go. But I'm going to share my screen. It won't matter for a second, and then I'll come back, and hopefully I'll fix it, and then I won't going to share my screen again. Okay, again. Okay. So here the Mishnah. The Gemara says like this. Tanya, this is a Gemara in Megillah 31a. The Gemara says, Tanya Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Amar Ezra tike lim yisrael shiyukorim klalot shebetorat kohanim kodem atzeret. Ezra, at the beginning of the Second Temple period, the second Moshe Rabbeinu, right? The Gemara says that the Torah should have been given to Ezra, but Moshe beat him to it because Ezra really revitalized Torah as the Jewish people were at a very, very weak point, totally assimilated. The people who came back to Israel were totally ignorant, totally assimilated, mamzerim, and Ezra basically re-established the covenant with the Jewish people. And the Gemara said, because of him, he re-established Torah. And the Torah should have been given to Ezra, but what can you do? Moshe Rabbeinu beat him to it. So the Gemara says, we gave him a prize. We changed the font of the Torah. We went from the Ktav Ivrit to Ktav Asherit. But Ezra really is viewed in Chazal as a second Moshe Rabbeinu. I think the Gemara says he lived to be 120. You know, he's like Moshe Rabbeinu. So he made... He said that we should read the Klalot in Torah Kohanim, that's our Parsha, before Atzeret, before a holiday of Shavuot, right? In the Mishnah, Atzeret is not Shmini Atzeret. In the Mishnah, Sukkot is Chag, and Shavuot is the Atzeret. It's like the Shmini Atzeret of Pesach, right? The Atzeret of Sukkot is what we call Shmini Atzeret, and the Atzeret of Pesach, the end of the Pesach season, we count, right? The Torah says, okay, you've thrown in Pesach, but it's not really over. You got another 49 days, another 50 days, so you count. So it's Seret goes to the conclusion of Pesach, who should be Mishnah Torah, Kodem Rosh Hashanah. You have to read it before Hashanah. So it's not because it's Parshat HaShavua. Now, you understand, everybody understands, there was no Parshat HaShavua now, right? There was no Parshat HaShavua when Ezra, or even if there was Parshat HaShavua, in Israel, they read the Parsha every 3 years. So when it says in the Mishnah, or it says here in the Gemara, that Ezra made a decree that they should read the Klalot before Shavuot, it means it was a special Torah reading, like we do on Parshat Shkalim, or whatever. No, we do on Yontif. So we ignore the Parshat of the week, and we do a total special reading of Yontif. It wasn't that it coincidentally, the way we have it, maybe not coincidentally, whatever, we do it before Atzeret, although we'll have to see, we don't. Another week in between. And then we have to read the one, in Kitavo before Hashanah, my Tama. Why do we do this? Amar Abaye, Kadesh Atich, Kadesh Atich, Vikli Lelotaha. in order that the year could come to an end, right? Everybody knows that Shavuot's the beginning of the year, right? You all knew that, right? You thought the year started on Rosh Hashanah. That's one year, but we have another year that starts on Shavuos. So we want to make sure, get rid of all the curses. Before the holiday of Shavuot, let's get rid of all the curses. So we read it then, and then we read it before Rosh Hashanah. We always read Kitavo before Rosh Hashanah. So before the new year, we get rid of it. So the Gemara's fine. Gemara's strange. They said, I understand before Rosh Hashanah. Bishlama Shavu Mishnah Torah. I get it. We read it before Rosh Hashanah. I understand. We want to read the curses before the year ends. Ela Sheba Torah Konim in Yikra, in Vayikra, our book. Atu Atzeret Rosh Hashanah. Did anyone, who ever heard that Rosh Hashanah, that Shavuot is a Rosh Hashanah? I never heard such a thing. The Gemara says, In, yeah, it is. Atzeret Nami Rosh Hashanah. Atzeret is also Rosh Hashanah. Why is Atzeret Rosh Hashanah? So before we go further, I mean, you can see it, but I just want to go right here. So the first Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah tells us there are four new years, right? There's, I always say, you know, there's the new year of the school. That's the day after Labor Day. There's a new year of January 1st. And then there's the new year of the baseball season in the end of March. And there's the new, you know, every, yeah, and then there's the new year on July the 1st. That's, I'm Canadian. Okay. So, the new year of Canada. So we have different new years. So we have one new year is the first of Nisan. And we have one new year on the first of Elul. We don't have to go into what their new year's for, whatever. That's not for now. Then we have, Bechad B'Tishrei. That's the third new year. That's the famous new year. And then we have the new year at the Beit. When is Tu B'Shvat? When is Tu B'Shvat on the first of Shvat? Then it wouldn't be called Tu B'Shvat. It would call that. It wouldn't go well. It'd be Olav Shvat. That doesn't sound so good. Is the new year for the trees on the first of Shvat? Or the 15th of Shvat. So this is an interesting debate, but I mean, they're four Rosh Hashanahs, but you'll notice Shavuos is not one of them. The Gemara says, yeah, Shavuos is also Rosh Hashanah. Why Shavuos Rosh Hashanah? It's not Rosh Hashanah. The Mishnah says they're four Rosh Hashanah, and Shavuos is not one of them. There's one in Nisan, there's one in Elul, there's one in Tishrei, and there's one in Shvat. So the Mishnah says the next one, Yatikaz on the next Mishnah. The next Mishnah says, "Ba'arba prakim olam nidon." So we think the world is judged again. You think it's only judged in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? No, the world is judged four times. Four times. Kalatua on Pesach, the world is judged for wheat. That's why we bring korbana omer, a barley, to sort of appease. I don't really like that word so much, but like you know, that's God should remember us. So we bring our first barley, our first harvest to the Beit Hamikdash. That's the korbana omer. But seret of peirat ilan, and that seret at the beginning of the fruit. Here it actually means wheat harvest, and that's the shtei halechem. I think people associate with bikurim, the fruits of the tree. Okay, also very nice. But in the Torah, the bikurim can be brought from Shavuos till Hanukkah time, at least till Sukkot, maybe till Hanukkah. That's the Mishnah talks about that. But it's a seasonal bikurim is brought seasonal on beginning at Shavuot. The shtei halechem, the two loaves of bread that are brought on Shavuot that have to be made of chametz, right? Unlike the opposite of Pesach, right? But everything in the Beit HaMikdash is always only matzah. That the shtei halechem, that's the perot ilan, really is brought on Shavuot, made of chametz. Barosh Hashanah, that's the biggie. The whole world, Jew and not. But Olam always means non-Jews. That means the whole world is judged. They were owned like sheep, whatever. And then Bechag and on Sukkot, we're judged for the water. See, these are the four judgments. So our Gemara and Megillah says, you know why Shavuot is a Rosh Hashanah? Because it says, Ubat Seret al Perot Ilan, because it says we're judged. That's the Mishnah. We judge on Rosh Hashanah. We're judged. But it's very funny. It should say, it's a new year, cause it isn't a new year. Like, it should say, cause it says Arba Rosh Hashanah, and one of the Rosh Hashanahs is Atzeret, but one of the Rosh Hashanahs isn't Atzeret. So it's a very funny Gemara. So now I'm going to stop sharing and hopefully get my video back. Please God. Yeah. Okay. What does it mean that then Atzeret is a new year? Right? The Mishnah says we read the Chukotai. The Brachon and the Klalot, at least, maybe not the whole parsha. I don't know what they did exactly. Ezra said they have to read the Brachon and Klalot. before Atzeret, before Shavuot, because Shavuot is the year end, as it says that we're judged on the Perot Ha'ilan on Shavuot. So it doesn't say it's the year end. So what do you see from the Gemara? I mean, what's clearly what the Gemara is saying is, what's the purpose of a year end? The purpose of a new year is to do tshuva. That, in other words, the Gemara is equating those first two Mishnayot of Rosh Hashanah, even though they're not exactly parallel. The only one that's the same is actually Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is one of the first new years, and it's also one of the four times we're judged. But the other 3 years, the other three new years, the first of Nisan, the first of Elul, and Tu Bishvat, we're not judged. But Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot, the Shalosh Regalim, and Rosh Hashanah, doesn't say anything on Yom Kippur, by the way. The day, Yom Adin is Rosh Hashanah. Yom Kippur is the opportunity to do tshuva between Rosh Hashanah, sort of to turn over what the din is. But the day of judgment is not Yom Kippur, it's Rosh Hashanah, according to the Mishnah. But anyways, but the Gemara here in Megillah is linking the two, or Ezra at least is linking to, which is very fascinating. It makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense. But the Rosh Hashanah, we call it a Yom, Atzeret is a Yom Hadin, a mini Yom Hadin, but therefore it has the status of a Rosh Hashanah. So that's very nice. So let me ask you a very simple question. Why don't we read it before Pesach or Sukkot? If we want to read it before, you know, so the year end curses, right? Why is Shavuot a year end? Because we're judged for Perot Ha'ilan, but we're judged on Pesach on wheat, and we're judged for Sukkot on water, and we're judged on, what did I say? And then we're just Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot. Okay. Rosh Hashanah. So we already have, we are reading it before Rosh Hashanah. So why don't we read it before Pesach or Sukkot? So before Sukkot, I understand. Ooh, it's 2 weeks after Rosh Hashanah. So, okay. The one from Rosh Hashanah will count, but why not read this one? Remember, there's no Parshat HaShavua here. Don't tell me, because it won't work with Parshat HaShavua. Why don't we read it before Pesach? I don't know that I have a real answer to this question. I mean, I have what I think is an answer, but I'm curious if anybody has any answers or any thoughts about that, or you probably never thought of that, right? So it's not like a common question. People, like, they can't sleep at night because they want to know why we read the Tochacha before Shavuot and not before, you know, Pesach, or Sukkot. But it probably, I mean, I'll say something very simple. I don't know if it's true at all. I mean, it's true. I don't know if it's is relevant, that Shavuot is basically a neglected holiday. Pesach, the Gemara is not so worried about. Pesach people, everybody does. I don't think, I wouldn't call it doing tshuva necessarily, but everybody celebrates Pesach. Pesach is the forming of the nation. There's a certain seriousness. But everybody knows Shavuot is like a neglected holiday. It's like, for Jews who are not religious, it's totally neglected. Oh, you're going to have a Jews who are not religious. In the time of Ezra, everybody was religious. No, in the time of Ezra, nobody was religious. How do I know nobody was religious in the time of Ezra? Nobody's a strong word, but I would imagine a much lower percentage than it is today. And I mean that in all seriousness, way lower percentage. How do I know that?
Only was worried about the intermarriage.
Yeah, he wasn't worried about intermarriage, for sure. So first of all, the
they were partying in Persia.
I'm sorry, they were partying in Persia. So that's before. So that's a little bit of a question. What's the timeline of Purim and Ezra? Let's leave that aside. But even if it is true, yeah, the Jews were assimilating in Persia, right? They assimilated in Babel. We know who went back to the land of Israel. So the Mishnah in Kiddushin said the Mamzerim, that's the Netinim, the Stukim. I'm not going to define it. A Sufi, Shtuki. And a Sufi means a Jew you pick up on the street, like a Suf. You gathered him in. The kids lying like in the bamboo cradle. If you remember that book, they went to China, this couple, and there was a baby girl lying on the street because with China, you could only have one child and people wanted to have a boy. So when they had a girl, they put the girl in the train station and they could get pregnant again and have a boy. I mean, I know it sounds ridiculous, but that's, if anybody remember the book, The Bamboo Cradle, that's how this totally not religious couple who were on a Oxford Road scholarship or something, on one of these fancy scholarships. And then that's how they adopt this baby. And now they live in Israel and they're very religious and blah, blah, blah. Very, very nice story. So that's an asupi. You pick up a baby in the street. You don't know Jewish. Not who are they? Were they? So those are the people who have no yichus, people who are the lowest of the low, went back to Israel. And we know, I'm afraid to share my screen again. Although
Ezra had to teach them how to celebrate the holidays again.
There you go. Ezra had to teach. I have to show it to you, even though I've shown this in my, I'll show it again. Hopefully we'll be okay. Ezra gathers them on Rosh Hashanah. Where are we going here? Ezra gathers the people on Rosh Hashanah, and it's in Nehemiah. I mean, Ezra and Nehemiah in the 24 books of Tanakh, Ezra and Nehemiah is one book. You know, it's not two books. We think of it as two books. I mean, probably most people don't think of it either. I don't know the last time people learned Ezra and Nehemiah. But so here of Nehemiah, Ezra really enters into a new covenant, like Moshe Rabbeinu. He enters into a new covenant. That's the Baruch Hashem Olam Amen Amen that comes from here a little bit. Okay, then Nehemiah comes, and then this is Rosh Hashanah. They tell the people, go home. It's Rosh Hashanah. Don't cry. Don't be all sad. It's a holiday. They didn't even know. They have no idea what the mood is on Rosh Hashanah. Ki Yom Kadosh Al Tayatzu. Don't be sad. So everybody went home. They went home. They had a party on Rosh Hashanah. Lachol, lishtot, lishloach, manot sounds like, you know, Purim. Lasot simcha gdola, kivinu bivrim. They understood what they were told. They never heard this. They didn't know anything about Rosh Hashanah. And on the second day, this is the first time we have 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. Right? With the Gemara, we say, Mimot Ezra. From the time of Ezra, Elul was never a 30-day month. Loi Reinu Ever Mubar was never a pregnant month. That's how the Gemara always refers to. A month of 3 days is quote unquote pregnant. So Bayom HaSheni, they got together and they found what it said in the Torah. Here we go. And this is really one of the most difficult psukim in all of Tanakh. They found in the Torah that they should sit in a sukkah. They never knew to sit in a sukkah before. Okay, so they were assimilated. Okay, I understand. They're Jewish today. Don't know from sukkahs either. So then he tells them out. He tells them, go to the mountain and bring alei zayit, alei shemen, alei hadas. That's not exactly the arba meaning. It's sort of a little bit like the lulav and etrog, a little bit not. Alei tzavot, the hadas, but not for the arba meaning to make a sukkah. I know you make a sukkah out of what's in the arba. And they went and everybody made a sukkah on their roofs. That's in this chapter, in this verse. And the people went out and in English roofs and their courtyards, and everybody made a sukkah that year. Wow. By Yeshua Sukkot, you know why? And this is one of the most difficult verses in all of Tanakh. Yoshua. That's Yoshua without the hey. Interesting. The hey that Moshe added because of the Meraglim, right? Binun. Yeshua binum b'nei Israel adayamahu, because they didn't observe sukkahs from the time of Yeshua binun until Ezra. That's 900, over 900 years, maybe 1,000 years, depending exactly when Ezra was. It's 850 years. They were in Israel, 70 years of exile, so we're up to 920 at least, and sometime after that. It could be 1,000 years. But these imcha gdola mo'ad. So and then they read of the Torah, and they taught Torah, and they very, very nice. Okay. So that's really quite startling. I mean, but whatever the case, let me see if I can get my, no, I don't know why this is happening, but okay. So that, give me a sec. Okay. So they were very not religious. They're very not religious to the people. So I don't know. I just think that Shavuot makes more sense, that it's a neglected holiday, and they wanted to give it really impetus. It's only one day. So Ezra made a decree that they should read, the Klalot before Shavuot. You know, Ezra, of course, is the one who established that we should read the Torah on Mondays and Thursdays, and Shabbos afternoon. According to the Gemara, Moshe Rabbeinu made the decree to read the Torah on Shabbos afternoon. It's an amazing thing. Moshe Rabbeinu, not as the receiver of the Torah, not as the interpreter of the Torah, not as the one who passed down the Torah from God to the Jewish people. Not that, I mean, it's the same Moshe Rabbeinu, but it's Moshe Rabbeinu in his role as a rabbi. It's a rabbinic law. We don't think of Moshe instituting rabbinic laws. Everything Moshe did is biblical. No, God told them X, Y, and Z, and Moshe added them. Moshe realized, and I've said many times, it's probably the most important and impactful rabbinic law there is. Can you imagine Jewish life if we didn't have Parshat HaShavuah? Boy, would Jewish life be different. And how people would know what's written in the Chumash. But it's really the most impactful rabbinic law made. That was done by Moshe on Shabbos morning. And the Gemara then says that they also did Mondays and Thursdays a little bit, because it says, they went 3 days in the desert and they didn't find any water. Ein mayim ela Torah. This physical and spiritual worlds go together. You cannot go 3 days without drinking water. You cannot go 3 days without public reading of the Torah. So they had to do Monday, Thursday. But the Gemara says, but the three Aliyah and Tem Sukkim, that was done by Ezra. And then Ezra made laning at Mincha on Shabbos afternoon. Why did Ezra make laning at Mincha on Shabbos afternoon? Ready? Oh, there we go. I disappeared again. Why did Ezra make laning at Mincha on Shabbos afternoon? So because the people who slept in on Shabbos morning, the Yoshvei Kranot, the people who hang out at the, on the street corners, Yoshvei Kranot, that's an expression where, you know, at the pool hall, I don't know what they're doing. They're on social media. Okay. And then they miss shul in the morning, but they came to shul for Mincha. Now we find that a little strange because we have way more people coming to shul on Shabbos morning than at Mincha. So that's why Ezra would establish the laning on Shabbos afternoon. So this was really a separate establishment that we should read Parsha Bechukotai with the blessings and the curses. Okay. Before Shavuot, it's as we discussed the importance of Shavuot and a year end and a Yom HaDin go together, even though the Mishnah and Rosh Hashanah separates them. There are four Rosh Hashanahs and 4 days of judgment. The Gemara and Megillah puts it together that since Shavuot is a day of judgment, we consider it to be like a new year. Okay. Let's discuss a little bit the Parsha itself. Okay. Now, I don't know, when I was growing up or now, you often hear, rabbis will talk about why do we read Parsha Bamidbar before Shavuot. So Tosfot already notes, we don't read it the week before Shavuot. Then we have to read it next week. So Tosfot says, and from what I can gather, this is just a change. Like, I don't think this is what Ezra wanted. I guess in the time of Ezra, we didn't really have Parsha Shavuot. I don't know, whatever it was, it still wouldn't matter. Tosfot says, we don't want to read the curses the week before Shavuot and Rosh Hashanah. That's like too depressing. You want to go on to Rosh Hashanah and Shavuot a little bit happier. So we're going to, Bamidbar, that's exciting. I don't know, the count of the Jewish people, the march to the land of Israel, or Nitzavim, we're always going to have a break. We don't want to do Kitavo, and we don't want to do Bechukotai right before Shavuot. Ezra clearly said before, Ezra didn't mean do it 10 days in advance. He meant to do it 3 days in advance. But Tosfot writes that we don't want to do that. So that would appear to me that's not like, we changed that. The Jewish people didn't feel comfortable fully implementing Ezra's decree. So they did Ezra's decree 98%. By the way, this, of course, only works if you live outside of Israel. I mean, even though Ezra was in Israel, but the way our Parsha, we don't do a special reading with Bukhutai. It's Parsha de Shavua. The way we have it set up, it works out to be Parsha de Shavua. But that doesn't always work in Israel because, we have this crazy system now when the last day of Pesach is on Shabbos. So Israel gets ahead of us because they don't have a last. I mean, they have a last day, but it's on the seventh day. They don't get the eighth day. So when the eighth day of our Pesach is on Shabbos, so in Israel, they're reading Achrimut, usually depending on the leap year, not leap year. They're reading one Parsha ahead. And we don't catch up till Matot Masay. It's one of my pet peeves that gets me really upset. I don't know why everybody's pet peeve. I have this real pet peeve about this. It bothers me to no end. I don't know. It's like a silly thing. It's not a silly thing. We should catch up the following week. Often they're reading Shmini. Tzav is always like Shabbos HaGadol. Let's say in a non-leap year. Shabbos Tzav. So they read Shmini. So the next week, they read Tazria. And Metzora. So why don't we just read Tazria Metzora and catch up in 1 week? So I've asked that question to a lot of people. They have this excuse, that excuse. Then part of this excuse is this. They want to get to Bechukotai before Shavuot. If we do it too quickly, what happens in Israel is they read Bechukotai like last week. Okay, this year there wasn't an issue. Pesach didn't end on Friday Shabbos. But when it's going to happen, I think next year, so then they're a week ahead of us. So they're actually going to read Bechukotai 3 weeks before Shavuot, not two. So that's already pretty far from what Ezra's saying. Then it's already not connected. So I guess within 30 days, maybe it's connected. So that is interesting. But the reason why it's a pet peeve of mine is because during the time when they had Parsha, when they established the Parsha HaShavua, so how many people traveled from Israel to Chutz Laaretz between Pesach and Matot Masai, Tisha B'Av, the week before Tisha B'Av? How many people traveled? In a busy year, maybe 10 people. I don't think 10 people traveled from Gutz Lars to Israel between April and August. Like, who in the world in the 1200s went from Israel? And they went, they weren't coming back. They didn't go two ways. They didn't. So like, but now, literally, I looked up the numbers once. It's over 1 million people. Over 1 million people go back and forth to Israel in the summer months. So there's 1 million people. Okay, so not all of them go to shul, whatever. So 1 million people hear one parsha twice and miss one parsha. It makes no sense. The rabbis have to change it. But okay, that's my pet peeve, that they have to change that. Anyways, okay, let's get to the parsha itself. This is really all introduction, but I told you I'm pinch hitting. So like, you know, intro, that's what I do, a long introduction. How to warm up a lot. Okay. Have a few things. We'll see what we get to. Okay. Why don't we start with the opening pasuk? It's always good to start at the beginning. So Rashi has, I think it's a pretty famous comment. He says, when it's repetitive, so Rashi says, what does it mean? So I would have interpreted Chukim and Mishpatim, the Torah 50 times said, keep my Chukim and Mishpatim. So we assume Chukim, whether it means laws, we don't understand, but we know there's a category of laws of Chukim, and there's a category of laws of Mishpatim. So he wanted to say, because Mitzvot is too broad a category, but still, whatever. But Rashi, you could say they're Chukim and they're Mitzvot, other Mitzvot, but Rashi says it's redundant, so we don't need it. The Torah could have said, et mitzvotai tishmaro. So Rashi says to you, amelim b'Torah. It should be amelim b'Torah. So what does amelim b'Torah mean? Like in yeshiva, amelis b'Taira. You know, what does it mean to you, amelim b'Torah? Anybody? Nobody? Everybody's afraid to speak up. Okay. I don't bite. So, yeah, I'm sorry?
Steiging.
Steiging, yeah. So I don't know Yiddish, right? So I know steiging, even though I don't know Yiddish. Yeah. So whatever steiging means, you have to sit on your tuchis, part of my language, and sit there. All the Yiddish I don't know, all the Yiddish words I'm saying, right? And you have to learn. Mainly means to sweat. I would say the best translation is to work hard, to sit and to really sweat and to work hard. And I just want to, for a couple minutes, I think we all know this, but I just, you know, this is, we don't know from this anymore. We don't do a mailing the Torah. We have it. It's our society. I'm not saying this as a critical comment, really. I'm just saying it as an observation. We today have Art Scroll and Koran, and nobody likes to do any work. You know, we don't, the idea of sitting and, you know, and breaking your head for 2 hours over a Tosfot, maybe it exists a little bit, but we're a generation, we've translated everything. You know, we take for granted the translation of the Talmud, and it's a wonderful thing. There's no doubt it's a wonderful thing. Art Scroll is responsible for 10 million hours of Torah learned a day, and I'm probably not even exaggerating. I'm probably not exaggerating. Maybe it's 5 million hours a day. How many million of hours of Torah learning happens because of the Art Scroll translation of the Talmud? It's millions. Anybody learns Daf Yomi? The reason Daf Yomi is more popular in America than it is in Israel is partly because of Art Scroll. I mean, they put it on the map, and it's not okay. All the other things they translated in English, and the purpose of the Art Scroll translation of the Gemara. Was my understanding was when they finished it, it's kind of interesting. They gave it to four women to read it. And women, of course, in that world who had never studied Talmud before. And the idea was, can somebody who's never studied Talmud, has no exposure to Talmud, can they read the English of Art Scroll and understand what's going on? And the goal was, if not, they had to change it. So that's the total opposite of to you on Meilim B'Torah. Because really, I would say there are, which is, maybe that's what our generation needs. I am not, every generation has its own ideas. The Meshech Chachma, I've discussed that in other times. Every generation has its own mitzvah, right? Every generation, he says the mitzvah in Egypt was no mitzvah, was to have Jewish cultural symbols, to speak Hebrew, not to change your clothes, right? That's where the Meshech Chachma develops that idea. That in Egypt, it was the culture that kept Jews alive. And in every generation, there's a particular mitzvah that takes on great historical importance. Rav Schachter, who was the one who introduced me to this Meshech Chochmah, then said that in our generation, they told me this already 30 years ago, but more, in our generation, the mitzvah is, you, you, Yishuv Aretz, to settle the land of Israel. There was the same mitzvah in the 1200s to live in Israel, but it wasn't the same mitzvah. Clearly it was, but we all know it wasn't. So every generation has its own challenges. So our generation needs it. We don't have we have 30-second sound bites and force, you know, and the internet's got a 1/10 of a second and speed and everything. So we need that in learning too. But there is an idea to break your head in learning, and even if you don't understand so much, because they're really the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. There's really two mitzvot. I mean, there's many aspects, but two of the basic mitzvot in Talmud Torah. There's a mitzvah to know Torah and there's a mitzvah to learn Torah. And people usually don't distinguish between them. But it's an important distinction to make. There is a mitzvah to know Torah. That's one mitzvah. So if you know a lot, you don't have to learn. And there's a mitzvah to learn Torah. By the way, and this is really crucial, I'm not getting into the whole discussion of women and Talmud Torah, but I'm sure everybody here knows that technically speaking, women are exempt from the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Women are only exempt from the mitzvah of learning Torah if they know Torah. There is no mitzvah. In other words, the mitzvah to know Torah applies equally to men or to women. The mitzvah to learn Torah, let's say you have a man and woman, they know the whole Torah already. They know everything. So fine, then the woman doesn't have to learn anymore. But before they know everything, the woman has an equal obligation to man. They both have to learn to know Torah. They have to know Torah. And then there's a mitzvah, even if you know everything, just to be involved in Torah. Because you're involved in Torah, that's a beautiful, the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, Keneged Kulam, means even if it's not practical, even if you know it, interacting with the divine, if you want.
I don't need it. I said just the fourth.
Okay, I hope that worked. So there's the mitzvah, and that applies again. I remember Rav Schachter basically telling us he thinks really the mitzvah to know Torah applies more to women than to men. And I don't know exactly today with the egalitarianism and everything, but in most homes, the woman has to know Hilchot Kashrut better than her husband. She for sure has to know Hilchot Nida better than her husband. She has to know Hilchot Bishul on Shabbos. I mean, it depends on the home you live in, but in, you know, the home Rav Schachter comes from, that's for sure true, that the woman has to know it better than the man. So that's one mitzvah. That's not what Rashi is talking about here. To you, I'm mailing b'Torah is not the mitzvah to know Torah, because often it's a contradiction. It is true. When you spend 2 hours breaking your head on a Tosfot, you're not learning so much. You're involved in the mitzvah of learning, but you're not gaining a lot of knowledge. You're gaining skills. You're gaining the excitement. You're gaining the understanding. That's all beautiful. So how you balance them, I don't exactly know. But I just, there is an idea, and we say that at every Siyum. We work and they work. We toil. I think how they translate Ameo, to toil, whatever that means. We toil and they toil. They meaning the non-Jewish world, the business world. And we toil and get a reward, and they toil and they don't get a reward. That's not true. I mean, they get lots of reward. They make lots of money. And so the answer is they make money on the bottom line. We make money on the effort, or we get reward for the effort. Amelim Torah means we get rewarded for the effort involved in Torah. If somebody is really gifted and is really smart, he knows everything and he doesn't learn so much. The person who knows a tenth as much but struggles harder, it's a greater mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Person who knows less because they're involved in the mitzvah. It's the mitzvah is the effort. Lepum tsara agra, if you want to split. According to the effort is the reward. So there are two mitzvot. There's the mitzvah to know Torah. And then, of course, you have to learn Torah to know Torah. So that's, we today focus on that. Maybe today we have to. Maybe we don't live in it, but maybe we lived in the shtetl. You don't have to know so much. It was by osmosis. The whole shtetl kept the Torah. We live in free, open societies. Knowledge is much more important. Right? That's the Chafetz Chaim's heter for women to learn Torah when they started, when the Chafetz Chaim got on the Beis Yaakov bandwagon. So what was his excuse then? In previous generations, the women didn't have to learn. It was sort of by osmosis, and they got it. Remember, today, there's such an open society, we have to do formal education. Okay, great. So maybe that's more important. But I just want to point out, I'll point out another little pet peeve since I'm in my pet peeve mood. Today, as I, one of my pet peeves is that they translate, and I don't mean to pick on the Mishnah Berurah, but I'll pick on the Mishnah Berurah. Like, if you can't read the Mishnah Berurah in the original, you should not be learning it. They have now the Mishnah Berurah in English. I don't know if they have the whole thing even. The Mishnah Berurah is not a book to read, be read in English. It's not for you. If you don't know Hebrew, you shouldn't be learning Mishnah Berurah. There's so many other, so people say, why do you say that? Because you have to know what's important. The Sefer HaChinuch is the best book to learn. I said earlier, the Sefer HaChinuch, 200 mitzvot and dvarim. Right? If there's one book, if you want to become knowledgeable in Judaism, just read the Sefer HaChinuch and you'll know like 80% of what you have to know almost. It's only a slight exaggeration. Sefer HaChinuch is the most amazing book ever written. In 500 short pages, in easy Hebrew, although it's translated into English too, but it's in easy Hebrew. He defines the mitzvah. He tells you the parameters of mitzvah, who it applies, when it applies, how it applies, the basic laws of every mitzvah. Just like that. You're really, you can pass yourself off as a serious Talmud Chacham. You know, you'll know a little about everything. You know the Sefer HaChinuch. What are you learning Mishnah Berurah for? Backwards and forwards, and the Eliyahu Rabbah says this, and then what's at that? That's for people who've learned for many, many years. It's not meant for everybody. So this idea today that we translate, like everything today gets translated, is, I think, ridiculous. It's certain books, it's important to have in English. Gemara too, maybe. Though, as I started to say, I never got that far. Yeah, when the art school started, Rav Menashe Klein was, okay, he's not from our world, but still, he was furious. This is awful. This is terrible. You can't have the Gemara's for people. Gemara was also never learned by everybody. 50 years ago, people, the way I'm saying you shouldn't translate the Mishnah Berurah, people said you shouldn't translate the Gemara. That if you don't know how to learn Gemara in the original, you shouldn't be learning Gemara. If you're learning Chumash, you should be learning Pirkei Avot, you should be learning Tanakh, you should be learning the Kuzari, whatever, you should be learning Tehillim, but what do you have to learn Gemara for? Most okay, so Daf Yomi changed the world. But anyways, so that's just one idea to Amelim B'Torah. Exactly how it applies today, I don't know 100%. By the way, this is also something, if we're going to say B'chukotah is the end of the Torah, you know, this the original, what could have been the end of the Torah, it also makes, it's a nice idea, end of the Torah. It's the process, right? When I ask you, what's the difference? Let's say in chat, you can do rabbinics or Talmud, right? You know, kids aren't, most of them aren't observant. So, you know, there are levels, you know, different levels of observance. So some kids will ask, what's the difference between Talmud and rabbinics? So I say rabbinics is like Torah Shebal Peh, halakha, whatever you want to call it. We take units, like Nimashur Adin, Kivud Abayim, whatever, we take units. And Talmud is Talmud. You learn Gemara. So I tell them Talmud is the process of learning and rabbinics is the bottom line. So some people, you know, like the process better. You don't, you can learn a lot more knowledge-wise not learning Gemara. You know, you can do six-page Gemara and you don't know if you're coming or going at the end. You don't know what the halakha is. We end up with a machloket and the Gemara never can reaches a conclusion and whatever. So that's, but the idea is to be involved in Torah. That's really what Rashi is saying. Okay, that's one thing. I want two more things. Hopefully we might have time for. Kedushat Beit HaKnesset. So Kedushat Beit HaKnesset appears in this week's Parsha. Where does Kedushat Beit HaKnesset appear in this week's Parsha? I'm not going to share my screen. Vashimoti Ad Mikdash Eichem. God says, I'm going to exile you and I will destroy your temples. Vahashimoti Amikdashek. I forget what the pasuk is exactly. Let's see if I can quickly find it. Torah talks about the Shemitah, the land, I'll throw you out, and the land can get all the Shemitah years it didn't do. But anyways, the Torah says Vahashimoti Amikdashekem. So here, it's very interesting. So the Gemara interprets Vahashimoti, I will destroy it, and yet it doesn't say Amikdashekem. It doesn't say your temples all destroy, which is the more Hebrew way. Mikdashechem Hashemu, whatever. It said that, Hashimoti, I will destroy your temple. So after it's destroyed, it's still called a temple. I will share my screen because I want you to see it. So the Mishnah in Megillah says that's where all the laws of Kedusha Beit HaKnesset are. In Mishnah, place for them. But the Mishnah says like this. The first chapter, I don't know why. Chapter 2, let me just get to 3. So the Mishnah says, V'odama Rabbi Yehuda, Be'Knesset Shecharav, a destroyed Beit HaKnesset, a shul that was once a shul, that's no longer shul. Don't say it's a church. I don't know. That's a whole different story. Ein maspidim mitocho. You're not allowed to give a eulogy. It's interesting. You're not supposed to give eulogies in shul. Sometimes we do it today. A great person passes away, but that's the shul is a place for tefillah and Talmud Torah. It's not a place for a hespedim. You know, there are people who wouldn't do weddings in shul. That's a whole different story. Ein mafshilim betocho chavalim. You can't put out your chavalim, what's that, ropes. So you have things you want to dry. Ein porshim letocho mitzudot. You can't put any traps to catch the who knows what, the animals or the mice. I don't know what. Ben shochtim al hagago peirot. You can't even go on the roof. The roof has kedusha. They used to dry out their fruits on the roof. Ben osin oto kapandria. This is the one halacha that's still like, so yeah, I think the most famous of these halacha. You're not allowed to make a shul a shortcut, right? You're only allowed to go in the shul to daven. You can't pass through, because it's, you know, I don't have to walk around the whole block. I'll just go through the shul. So that you're not allowed to, unless you sit there for 5 minutes and take out a Mishnah and you learn Mishnah. Shenemar, as it says in our week's parsha, even when they are destroyed, they are considered, have their holiness to them. And then you can't even mow the grass. I don't know what this means. Exactly. I don't know anybody who followed that. I never heard of such a thing, but that's what it says in the Mishnah. Alubo asavim, if the grass is growing wild, right? Lo yitlosh, don't take it away. This used to be a shul and a shul. Look what it is now. And therefore you want to see the ugliness. And on the one hand, it's funny. There's like a tension. On the one hand, you want to make look nice. If the shul maintains its kedusha, even when it's not in use, so you have to look really nice. On the other hand, you want to have a memorial to what once was. So you have to have this your mourning also. Let's see if I can get this to work. Maybe okay. So that's this week's parsha, Kedusha Beit Knesset, which is I would say a problem we have today, if I can say that. Our shul, you know, I don't think was there a campaign recently, not people shouldn't bring their smartphones into shul. I think that's a great idea. I mean, all kinds of things that we do that don't have Kedusha Beit Knesset. You know, I've said many times, I know I'll get into trouble when I say it, but it's okay. Having a machitz in shul, so that's part of the salvation. That's part of kedushat beit haknesset, but that's one of the lower things of kedushat beit haknesset. Not talking in a shul is more important than kedushat beit haknesset. In other words, I know sociologically that's not how we operate today, but there's no doubt, halachically speaking, a shul that is quiet with mixed seating has more kedusha than a shul that has noise and is with a machitza. There's absolutely no doubt about that. You can look, you won't find anywhere in the Shulchan Aruch any halachas about the machitza. It's never mentioned. I'm not saying, but not talking shul, the Mishnah Berurah, I don't want to, you know, the Mishnah Berurah basically says you shouldn't go to shul. So I wouldn't advise that today. Today it's important, whatever it is, maybe it's better in some shuls. I don't know. It's all over the place. But Kedusha Beit Knesset is a serious issue. And again, you know, that's the question. You want kids running around, like how much, what gets tolerated? But really, I mean, the Sri Deish has a tshuva. Can you even have a lecture in a shul? Have a lecture on Jewish history. So of course we think that's wonderful. I guess fine. It's wonderful. But, it's not so clear that, halakhically speaking, it's really allowed. We have a notion that we build our shuls all tonight. That our shuls are built, that they don't have full kedusha beit knesset. You know, one of the differences between a beit knesset and a beis medrash, you're not allowed to eat in a shul. You're not allowed to eat in a shul. You're allowed to eat in the beis medrash because you're there all day learning, but you're not allowed to eat in a shul. You have all these, but a lot of shuls, they have shalashutis right in the shul. You know, that's very common. Or kiddush right in the shul. And, so whatever. So we say we build our shuls all tonight, but, yeah, whatever. I just want to point out that, I don't know, something to be concerned about. The Gemara that takes Kedusha Beit Knesset very, very seriously. And, if you can't even put your fruit to dry on a destroyed shul on the roof, imagine, you know, what you have to do inside a shul that's not destroyed. In other words, the shul is not even a shul anymore and you're not allowed to walk through it. You can't walk through it as a shortcut because 50 years ago it was once a shul. Nobody's done in there in 50 years. And it was once Sure. So I don't know. It's just something we should think about a little bit. And there's another one of my other pet peeves. I'm on my pet peeve week. You know, a shul is supposed to be the nicest building in the city. So yeah, very. You know, I was once talking to somebody who said, you know, the shul doesn't have any money. I said, what are you talking about? The shul, there are like 50 millionaires in the shul. I said, yeah, they're 50 millionaires. The money's in their homes. It's not in the shul. You know, what you won't tolerate from your home, you can't tolerate in the shul. If you can't tolerate, you know, the you need a paint job or the wallpaper or the hardwood floors, things you wouldn't put up with in your home, you're not allowed to put up with in your shul. So if the community really is poor and everybody lives in the, you know, run down apartments and who knows what. Okay, so the shul can be run down. But if you live in a, you know, 3,000 square foot home and two cars and four bedrooms and go on vacation twice a year, so the shul's got to look like a very nice place. So again, I don't know how to translate this into practice, and I don't want to go for, I'm not here to criticize anybody, but this is, you just look what the Mishnah says, what it's doing thing. Okay, yeah, I'll get back to the comments somebody just threw out to me privately. Okay, and then just let me end. I see it's getting late, so that's one thing. And I just really want then tying in all of Vayikra, right? I started by saying, you know, that we could have, the Torah on a certain level could have ended at Bechukotai. It should have. Had we not had the sin of the Meraglim, so much of the Torah would not have been necessary. We would have to throw in Dvarim elsewhere, but the book itself, the books of Bamidbar and Dvarim basically wouldn't be needed. What's the opening word of Vayikra? It's Vayikra. That's why it's called Vayikra. Vayikra means he called out. So everybody knows, I think, there's a little Aleph, right? The Aleph. Why is there a little Aleph? Why is there a little Aleph?
Vayikir.
Right. What's the difference?
Vayikir happened upon him.
Happenstance, like a temporary. Vayikar alim et bilam, right? Vayikra is Lashon endearment of Lashon chiba, Rashi says. God loves us, right? All the books of the Torah begin with the idea of love, counting God loving the Jewish people. Vayikra Moshe, I love you, Moshe. I'm going to call out to Moshe. As opposed to Bilam, Vayikar, you know, I happen to bump into you. Hello. You bump into a friend, you say hello. The friend who you really like, you call them up. You arrange to meet them. So that's Vayikra. Vayikra. And really, I think the theme of the book is our relationship with God a relationship of Vayikra or Vayikar? Because what's the curse is Im Techuim Mi Bekeri, Vayikar, Rashi, Vayikar. It's all temporary. The Klala is when we bump into God, you know, okay, you know, it happens to be. Instead of making an appointment, making God a permanent part of my life. So that's really what Vayikra is all about, is, and that's where the Aleph is so small. We have to determine, do we make the Aleph big or do we get rid of the Aleph? And that's, therefore, the curses are when we get rid of the Aleph, or when the Aleph is very small. So that's really the, I would say, the overarching theme of it. By the way, I'll end with, you know, I said that a shul maintains its status even when it is destroyed. I actually think there's a beautiful, hopeful message here. In other words, what are the rabbis saying? I think what the rabbis are saying is these shuls will one day be shuls. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah says that all the circuses are going to turn into shuls, and all the Batei Midrash and Babel will go to Israel, turn into shuls. So I think the rabbis are saying, you know, the shuls are destroyed now. The Jewish people are in exile. I mean, wait, these things were developed when the Jews were suffering, and, you know, and the Jews are in exile. And, you know, but yes, you have to treat what's once as a shul, but you have to treat what's once a shul as a shul, because one day it'll be a shul again, or at least, we have to have that attitude that the Jewish a shul is a permanent thing and it will remain permanent, but it's not Vayikar, it's for all time. Okay, just a quick review, which I already did half of it. The Torah should have started, could have ended at Bechukotai, and that's why the last pasuk in the parsha is that this is what God said at Har Sinai from Yitro till the end of Vayikra is basically all laws. You don't have any stories anymore, pretty much. And that's it, and we're finished. Okay, but it so happens Dvarim has 200 laws, but that's, they were probably given earlier. We had to write it, but the Dvarim was only written, was only said because Moshe had to prepare the next generation to enter the land, and half of Bamidbar is after the sin of the spies. So obviously that wouldn't have been needed. And of course, and then thematically, we like to end with a curse and not a curse, a blessing. I mean, a blessing. So that makes sense. The Moshe then warns him at the end, and then he warns him again when it didn't happen. They had to add on two new books. So he had to warn them again in Kitavo, again, the blessings and the curse. When we talk about Ezra establishing, we should say before Shavuot, because it's the year end, even though it's not really the year end, it's the year end and the Yom HaDin, because the idea of a new year is to do with Yom HaDin. What about Sukkot? Yom HaDin? We said Shavuos is, we wanted to make it more important. Pesach, Sukkot, people celebrate it. They know what it's like, even though in the time of Ezra, they weren't so into Sukkot. But I think we want, because, okay, maybe there are only two. They didn't want to read it more than twice. They only wanted twice. They picked Shavuot. Of course, if they would have picked Pesach, it would have asked the same question. But I think there is a reason. Shavuos is sort of a lonely holiday, right? Matan Torah is not in the Torah either. That's for a whole other shiur. Right, Matan Torah is not mentioned in Shavuot. Shavuot is very little. There's nothing there. It's all agriculture, which doesn't, if you're not a farmer, there's nothing on Shavuot. So anyway, so that was to warn us that it's a really important day. This too is a Yom HaDin. This too is the end of the year. We separate it by a week because we don't want to do it right before Rosh Hashanah, right before Shavuot. So we take a week off. And then we talk about Ezra a little bit, the personality, the refreshment emotions. We talk about Amelie Mitorah, that there's two mitzvot. There's the mitzvah to study Torah and the mitzvah to know Torah. And there are two, often those mitzvot almost contradict each other. They can be at odds with each other. There's a tension between the mitzvot. But everybody, man, woman, everybody has to know the Torah the same. The mitzvah to learn to be a mailing the Torah, to engage and gross yourself in Torah, work hard and break your head and struggle. That's a separate special mitzvah. And okay, we live in a generation where people don't like to struggle. It turns them off from the subject. Okay, what can you do? But, and that's, and then we talked about Kedushat Beit HaKnesset a little bit, and okay, and that we should have a permanent relationship with God. So he sees God. So he's me, if I can say that, which is fine. There we probably go. You just made a very controversial statement. Mixed eating has Kedusha. The Beis HaMikdash had a separate area for women. I don't know exactly what is Kedusha or not correct. The Beit HaMikdash, the idea of a machitz is mentioned in the Beit HaMikdash, but it's never quoted. See, we come from a generation. We come from the era where this was the battle cry. An Orthodox Jew was if he went to a shul with a machitza, that was it. That became. But that's sociological. I'm not trying to downplay the importance, but like that's not the halakhically most important thing about what you do. But it's so ingrained that even minyanim that have women aliyot, even the partnership minyan, don't dream of getting rid of the machitza. Machitza became the symbol. But it's halakhically, if you're drinking pure halakha, which we can't live in a pure halakhic world. We, of course, are influenced by sociological. What I said is that a shul where they talk has less kedusha than a shul that doesn't have. I just said a quiet shul with its mixed seating has more kedusha than a noisy shul with several seating. And I 100% stand by that statement. The ideal in Jewish law is the shul with the mechitza and quiet. But it's like when Rav Avadya you say, well, I don't want to get into that, but that's, you know, what's worse, a mini skirt or pants, whatever. So it's just a question about, you know, that's all I was saying, right? We're so accustomed to the machitza being so important that we've made it into more important than it really is. And we forgot about it. It's always like that. I always say it. We only have so much strength to fight battles, right? I always use it, the ethical and the ritual. If we put all our efforts religiously into ritual, we don't have enough left for ethical. Human beings only have so much strength. You can only say Avinu Malkeinu after October 7th for so long. I imagine most of the shuls don't say Avinu Malkeinu anymore. People can't take it anymore. It's too much. And that's a little nothing. That's a little minor thing. We only have so much religious energy. So if you're going to use it all on ritual and be machmir here, be machmir there, you don't have anything left for the basics. And that's true about everything in life. We all know that. You have to use your energy wisely. So we put so much effort into making sure our shuls have a machitza. That was the definition of Orthodox. And maybe a good historical, whatever, sociological things, who knows? But it came at the expense of other things. It's like what Emmanuel Feldman wrote in Tradition many years ago. He wrote what was he writing about? He was writing about, unfortunately, all the so-called religious people who cheat in business. And he said, when we came to America, you know, the rabbis were, there was no kashrut, there was no Shabbos, there was no mikveh, there was no nothing religiously. So they worked their butt off. And there's amazing people who created a Orthodox infrastructure, mechitzas, Orthodox shuls everywhere, day schools and mikvehs and kosher restaurants and kosher food, the OU, amazing. And they didn't talk about business. They just thought it was natural. Obviously, you have to be honest in business, but they forgot about it. Like, nobody ever talked about it. So it went by the wayside. It's just the way, if you never hear the rabbi talking about it. I haven't mentioned for a long time. Rav Schechter told us every year he would give a shiur on Lo Tignov. He would say things like, you have to pay your taxes. And, you have to give back the change. And you have to, and you're not allowed to steal. You're not allowed to shop. And he would tell us, he's giving the shiur because a student of his once had been a very good student of his, got arrested on tax fraud or something like that. So they, how can you do it? A religious person, how could you cheat? He said, I was in yeshiva for 10 years and I never heard a shiur that you can't cheat. I heard shiur in Shabbos, Erevin, everything. I never heard the rabbi talk about not cheating. So I don't want anybody to ever finish my shiur and they can say they never heard a shiur, you can't cheat. That's more important than if the food is kosher or not. Not just more important than glatt kosher, more important than kosher. Not to cheat. So, what can I tell you? I have my own, whatever. Okay. So you don't have to, feel free to disagree with me, but, on this,
Sephardim don't talk in shul.
I know it's beautiful. I don't want to say what people say about that. Yes, it is. No, I think it's better. I think there are a lot of shuls today where people don't talk. It's improved, I think, overall, but it's many shuls need a lot of room for improvement.
Yeah.
And the excuse, that in the Reform Shul, they're like, they're guests, so they're quiet, in the Orthodox Shul, they feel at home. That's a nice Baba Maisa, very nice. It's nice. You want to be Melamed with your Rav Levi Yitzchak of Bertichev. They want to tell God, they feel at home. They're like, okay, I get it. But we know halachically that holds no weight. Okay. Let's see if there are any other questions here. It's for, Right. I said that the mailing. The other question is not how many hours, how many useful hours. It's also true. You have to have a business sense when you learn. You have to know, right. When I say break your head, you're right. You have to know where to draw the line. Okay. Enough already. Go on. Don't spend hours if you don't understand. I'm talking about when you're understanding the depth of Torah with understanding. If you don't understand something, then it is good to move on. You're right. You have to know where to draw the line. Okay, I think that's it. Thank you very much. Tomorrow morning, 9:15, I give my regular shiur on the Seder that I didn't have time now I have to prepare because the time I was preparing for my parsha shiur is when I had anyways. Yes.
Could I ask a technical question?
Sure.
In the last week, when I hit the link to the shiur that it's been coming up asking you.
Patrick, yeah, I don't know. Did anybody have that problem? I know. On the other night, people said they when they clicked the link, they had to put in the password. I don't know if you still I have no idea. How Zoom you had that issue today?
Yes.
I don't know why that's happening. I really don't
need
know.
Password.
I'm sorry?
Still requires a password for this shiur just now.
Yeah. So I don't know what's happening. And I really don't know. And I don't, okay, I'm going to have to, I don't know. Okay. All right. I don't know what to say. It requires a password. And I don't know why that is. Because we didn't do anything differently. And okay. Knows how to solve that. Please let me know. Maybe the link, I don't know, but it's the same link. We didn't do anything differently. We just sent out the same email.
No, it was different last week from Friday to Sunday.
But you got in without putting in the password, right?
No, I had to.
Even tonight, you had to put in the password too?
Yes.
Yeah.
Is there anybody who got in the password just clicking on the link? Nobody? Okay. Okay, so I don't know what to say, but anyways, okay.
If you fix it, it'd be great because sometimes if your hands aren't working, it can be really hard to put in the password.
Yeah, so I have no idea why. I'm going to ask people who know more than I do, and maybe they'll be able to figure out if there's something wrong. I have no idea. I don't know if it's a Zoom issue, like another, or it's an issue on somehow with our Zoom account, and I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sorry. Let's see what we can do. Especially
do you have a technical person there?
We do, but I don't know if they'll know Zoom, and you can't talk to people in Zoom unless you have some super duper account. You can't talk to them. You have to email them. They won't talk to you on the phone. So I'll ask our tech support people. Yes, I will ask them. But thank you. Okay. I hope to clear it up. If not by tomorrow morning, whatever. At least our program on Sunday on Shavuot. If you haven't signed up, our Yom Iyun. If you're in,
it's a big day. It's a big day. It better work.
Yeah, I mean, it works. You're all here. It works. It's just you have to do an extra step, and I have to let people know that they shouldn't think if they're locked out, right? That it could be there are people who don't come because they clicked the link, they didn't get in, and they didn't realize what they have to do. But at least, all right, we'll see what we can do. And please, God, look forward to.
Oh, man, it was fun. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Terrific share. Thank you.
But okay, now it doesn't matter. Okay, here, there we go. Okay, yeah. Shabbat shalom, everybody.
It was a pleasure. Shabbat shalom.
Okay, thank you, thank you. Shabbat shalom. Sanctity of the synagogue. Yes, of course. That was with the fights over the pizza. What's his name? Baruch Litwin, I think. They went to the Supreme Court. Yeah, they threw huge issues. But I'm talking halakhically. I'm not talking the sociological arguments of the pizza. That's a totally it's a separate thing. Okay. Laila Tov.